In this hour of Focus 580, this second, what would be our second hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about, at least to start, we'll be talking about Iran, the politics of Iran and the relationship between Iran and the United States. And we have as our guest this morning a scholar who has spent a long time following Iranian politics and also more broadly the politics of the Middle East, Ervan Abrahamian. He's an historian at Baruch College, which is part of the City University of New York. He's authored a number of books about Iran. And if you're interested in reading about Iran, you can head out to the library or the bookstore, look for his books. They include Iran Between Two Revolutions, The Iranian Mujahideen, Khomeiniism, and Tortured Confessions. He also has contributed to a book that is coming out soon, to be published by the New Press, titled Inventing the Axis of Evil. The subtitle is The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. So you can look for that. Also this morning as we talk, as always, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep our program moving and accommodate as many different callers as possible. But, of course, we welcome people into the conversation. In Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you should feel welcome to call. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
We appreciate it. I didn't mention, perhaps I should here, I'll also mention right at the beginning that our guest is going to be giving a talk on the Iranian politics and U.S. foreign policy as part of the Millercom series. And that will be this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center on the campus. And all of these talks are always free and open to the public. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you're interested in hearing him, you should certainly feel welcome to attend. I thought that we might talk to begin, at least, about the recent elections in Iran and what they mean. 4 years ago in 2000, this was a year in which a lot of Iranians turned out, and they gave a great victory to the people that are called reformers in Iranian politics. This time around, now the result was very, very different. Now, you can argue that it had something to do with the fact that a number of people who would have stood as reform candidates weren't allowed to run. But it was also a significant victory for the conservatives. And so I'm interested in I'm trying to get a better understanding and having you talk a little bit about how exactly we read the outcome of this election.
As you said, it's a victory for the conservatives, but it's a very pyrrhic, bogus victory because on one hand, they do control now parliament, which is a very important institution there. But for the last 10 years in Iran, what's been important in elections has been participation. The republic has taken a great deal of pride that when there are elections, there is massive participation. And in the victory of the reformers in the last parliamentary election, previous parliamentary election, then in the two presidential elections, the participation rate was staggeringly high. It was something like 80% of the public participated. If you keep in mind that in America it's hard to get 50%, it's you're getting, in fact, you can say genuine participation. And it was often youth that dragged their parents to go and vote because people felt that these elections were meaningful. And in those elections, the reformers swept the polls in two presidential elections, in one parliamentary election, and actually in one local provincial elections. So those were seen as major landmarks, I think, it was almost as important as the revolution itself, because here you had, in a way, participatory democracy, and it worked, and reformers, and in Iran, actually, the reformers is much more important than just the slight word reformers. They were questioning very fundamental issues in what had been perceived in the past as Islamic. They were reforming not just politics, but reforming Islam as a religion. Now, their defeat in this election is then considered as a major backward step. Mm-hmm. Because what it does mean is, first of all, reformers no longer have this majority in parliament. But even more important, the republic has in many ways lost its legitimacy in terms of participation. By banning the reform candidates, much of the reform supporters basically sat out the election. So voter participation rate dropped from 80% to the official number is 51%, but probably less. And in major cities like Tehran, where before it would have been more than 80%, it dropped to 32%. And what poll analysis in Iran have done, there is actually an ability to actually analyze polls there like here. Their analysis is that of the 50% that voted, 15 to 20% are the core of the conservative voters. To use American terms, they're the base of the conservatives. So they will come out whatever happens and support for the conservatives. And the reformers were very much split. Many reformers sat out, and that accounts for the dramatic decline. But the other percent to add up to 51% is accountable partly by people voting for sort of insurance, because they feel that if they don't vote, there's no record of them voting, they might be penalized in terms of jobs and so on. Mm. That's often a more imagined fear than real fear, but there's always that concern. Then there was, I would say, the one wing of the reform movement who followed the president, Khatemis, who was a reformer. Their policy was that even if the elections are not meaningful, you still need to vote because it's the legitimacy of the republic of the state. So people did go vote just to show that they are still supporting the republic as such, even though they don't like the candidates, in order to give it some legitimacy. So you have this dramatic decline in voting, but it's not down to only the core of the regime, which is at most 15 to 20% of the electorate. Mm.
So the decline in participation in part was a silent protest by some people because they're saying we didn't have the opportunity to vote for the candidates that we wanted to vote for.
Yes.
Was there any sense, and in some of the things I have read, there was the suggestion, though, that also there was that people were disappointed in the inability of reformers to follow through on promises they made in 2000 when the last election was held. That there was some disillusionment in their ability to fulfill their agenda.
Yeah, the failure of reformers it can be explained a number of ways. One is usually the way that you explained it, that they had, in fact, once they were in parliament, they passed over 50 very dramatic reform bills about judiciary, about taxation, about rights of individuals, banning of torture. But almost all these reform bills were axed by the Guardian Council, which is like a Supreme Court, but even more powerful, that can veto legislation. So much of that reform legislation basically was vetoed. Mm-hmm. And that then created for the reformers a dilemma. What are they going to do since they hit a cul-de-sac? Some reformers were talking about more actually militant activities, even calling for a referendum, because you can, and by the Constitution, if you get enough two-thirds support in parliament, you can ask for a change in the constitution. You could then change the constitution to strip the Guardian Council of some of these extraordinary powers. So there were more militant reformers who were talking about this. Now, they were inhibited by two things. One was the president, Khatami, who is the main reformer, did not want to challenge, did not want a confrontation. He's very basically, I would say, moderate, mild person who wants to work within the system, and he's not willing to create a crisis. But also what undermined the reformers, and it's not often mentioned here, is U.S. foreign policy. The axis of evil speech, and then the invasion of Afghanistan and its American bases in Afghanistan, Central Asia, Azerbaijan, and now, of course, the invasion and occupation of Iraq. This has pulled the rug out from the liberals, because if you place yourself as a liberal in Iran, what you see is then the nation is threatened by a major power that is surrounding it. And this major power has been consistently talking about overthrow of the republic, regime change. So if in that context, if you are militant about talking about reform, you can easily be labeled as a stooge of the United States, as a spy of the United States, a fifth column. And you don't want to be obviously tarred by that. But also a lot of the reformers don't want to rock the boat at a time when the boat seems very unstable because of the United States in the vicinity. So that accounts for why the reform movement in a way split in the middle. And you can see this quite clearly in the debates between the president, Khatami, and his younger brother, who is in the head of the Reform Party. And Khatami, the president, said we should have to vote, even though the vote is not really meaningful. The brother advocated that the supporters should abstain because as a protest vote. And the two issues, the two were already issuing, debating also how much the country was in danger or not. For the president, the country is in sort of dire threat, and therefore you have to be very careful what you do in internal politics.
Let me reintroduce our guest for this part of Focus 580 for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking with historian Irvand Abrahamian. He's a professor of history at Baruch College in New York City and has for a long time now been following the politics of Iran, has written several books on the subject, and also more broadly is interested in politics of all of the Middle East. He's visiting the campus. We'll give a talk this afternoon about Iranian politics and U.S. foreign policy. And if people who are listening right now have questions, you welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I have, and again, in some of the articles that I've read since the election, when people are talking about where the reformers and the reform movement is headed, people have said something like, well, as far as participation in government is concerned, we almost consider it done, over. But they are saying, in a larger sense, the reform movement is not over, that there are still people who are interested in trying to make some changes. But that, I guess, raises the question, well, then what? I mean, what happens to the people who consider themselves reformers, and where do they go now? What do they do now?
Well, there will be some reformers still in parliament. They're not completely purged. We don't know how many, but even if they're a handful, they will still be able to get a national audience through the parliament. But the reformers that withdrew from the election, their strategy is now to, what they say is to go to civil society, basically to organize professional groups, political interest groups, try to get a strength in the public and link issues with more down-to-earth civil rights issues and civil liberties. So that's their going to be their strategy. Now, the problem is how far they can do this if the press is very much controlled. In the past, the reformers had a great impact because if they published a newspaper, overnight the newspapers would become basically mass circulation papers. Literally within a week, if you started a newspaper that was reformist, it would dwarf the conservative established newspapers. Now, people really rushed out to see to get them. That obviously avenue is going to be pretty closed. They might let some moderately reform papers be published, but on the whole, nothing is going to be permitted that's going to challenge the regime. Their ability to basically work in civil society will be also, I think, very much restricted. So that may not work very well. But their hope would be that next time there is an election, they might have some opening. That'd be 4 years from now. And, of course, 4 years in politics is a long time.
Mm-hmm. You know, whenever people talk about politics in Iran and use terms like conservatives and reformers or conservatives and liberals, I'm sure that Americans, when they hear those terms, they view that through the lens of American politics. And they perhaps might think of what here in the United States we talk about when we talk about conservatives and liberals. And I'm always concerned that that one has to take that and put it in the Iranian context and ask the question, well, what in Iran, in its politics, what does it mean to be a conservative or to mean to be a reformer, particularly as far as reformers are concerned, with what in what ways would they like to see Iran and its government change?
Paradoxically, it's not that different from U.S. Right. There are similarities. And the conservatives are very much rely on religion. So it's a sort of notion that you take your word from the clerical leaders. They know best. The inspiration should come from the Quran and the teachings of the prophets and so on. For reformer, and therefore when it comes to law, they would be basically saying the law should come from the religious Sharia. For reformers, the premise is individual liberties, that each person has basic rights, and these individuals are also equal, should be treated equally. The law should respect their rights, and one should have the basic freedoms of expression, religion, and so on. So it very much counters the conventional, traditional interpretation of Islamic Sharia. So this conflict is a very genuine and I would say very deep-seated conflict. It's not a conflict easy to resolve. And this is very new, in the Middle East, that you have people from an Islamic wing, which these reformers are. They're not from a secular wing, but from an Islamic movement, completely reinterpreting Islam to, in a way, incorporate the basic beliefs of the Enlightenment. And this would not have been acceptable in the past. And, of course, the conservative traditionalists do not accept. They actually considered it blasphemous. So many of these reformers have been pulled before courts on precisely the charge of blasphemy, which is the most serious charge you can accuse of someone. And, of course, the penalty for blasphemy is death. So you get big trials of some reformer charged with blasphemy, and it becomes a fiasco because, of course, the public sympathizes with the person in the dock. And eventually what happens is the person is found guilty of some charge of undermining the Republic and given a fairly light sentence. So actually the penalty for blasphemy is not obvious, is not implemented because it would be considered too outrageous.
Right now, for the United States, I think the focus of concern, one major focus of concern with Iran, is the feeling of the U.S. government that Iran is interested in developing nuclear weapons, which prompts, I guess, a question of from the Iranian perspective, what sort of security concerns do they have, and in could one view this as a legitimate sort of response to a genuine perception on their part that they are threatened?
They feel more threatened now than before, and I think that might be even a factor that the conservatives are pushing quietly behind the scenes to continue with the nuclear program. They feel more threatened now because of, obviously, the U.S. In Iraq. Their reading of the situation is that Iraq was invaded because it didn't have nuclear weapons, but North Korea has been treid with kid gloves. They do have nuclear. So that sort of message has come through. But besides the United States, even if this present Iraqi situation wasn't there, even if the Axis speech wasn't there, there was a national, basically, program for developing a nuclear weapon in the long run. Actually, the Shah was interested. The Shah started in 1974, and it was for a while disbanded and then restarted. And there the concern, well, that one is the concern that the region is, of course, a dangerous neighborhood. Pakistan had the nuclear weapon, and there's been a lot of rivalry between Iran and Pakistan, and of course about Afghanistan. In many ways, the war in Afghanistan was between the Northern Alliance, was supported by Iran, and the Taliban, which was supported by Pakistan. So The Iranians saw the Pakistanis as regional rivals. And besides that, security is also the question of national prestige, and basically that if you do have the nuclear bomb, you're part of the nuclear club. And so nationalists in Iran, whether they're conservative or reformers, tend to sympathize with the idea of having a nuclear bomb at some point. The question is, at what point? The conservatives, on the whole, would want it sooner. The reformers are willing to put it off for a while if that gives them better security, if there are sort of guarantees given to them that there is no danger from outside.
When President Bush made his now famous speech talking for the first time about the axis of evil, what did people in Iran think? Was it a surprise? Did they say, where did this come from? Or did they say, well, we're not surprised at all. That's exactly what we expect from the United States.
It came as a bolt out of the blue sky. It was complete surprise because in the previous year, actually, things had been very much improving between the two countries. In the war in Afghanistan, Iran had actually helped. Without Iran, I don't think the Taliban would have fallen that easily. The setting up of the government in Kabul was done with the help of the Iranian government. In fact, it was said that in the meetings in Geneva, State Department officials and Iranian Foreign Office Department were actually walking hand in hand. Because they were basically putting together a deal that would create the new government. So there was a lot of basically move, detente, rapprochement between the two. So when the Axis of Evil speech came, it was a complete surprise, and not just for Iran. I think it was a big surprise for the State Department. Powell and Armitage had not seen this speech. And for them, their strategy was, in fact, to continue negotiations, dialogue with Iran. And their reaction was, this speech is actually going to destroy the liberals, reformers, and that's going to jeopardize our relations between the two.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was a State Department official after the axis of speech who said that some people, he didn't name the people, but obviously people who'd helped write the axis of speech, evil speech, needed some psychotherapy sessions.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We have a caller. Would welcome others if you have questions for our guest, Yervand Abramian. He's an historian at Baruch College in New York City and has written a great deal about Iran and its politics and also about the politics of the Middle East. He is the author of several books, so if you're interested in reading about Iran, you can look for those. Also, I want to mention again a book to which he contributed, which is soon to be published by the New Press, and that book is titled Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. For people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, he'll be giving a talk about Iranian politics and U.S. foreign policy as part of the MillerCom series, and that will take place this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center, and that's on Illinois Street in Urbana. And these programs are always open to the public and free, and so anyone who's interested in hearing from him should stop by. Questions on the program, too, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Lafayette, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about Iran in relation to what's going on in Iraq right now. For example, this young cleric, Sadr, some people say that he has connections with Hezbollah, and I had always thought that that was originally an Iranian group. I know it's got it's all over in Lebanon and Palestine, places like that. But and then, you know, there's the Iranian-born so-called moderate cleric al-Sistani. So I'm just wondering about those two and their relation to Iran. And also the Bush administration talks about, you know, that we're going to bring democracy to the Middle East, and it looks like maybe it might turn into chaos. I'm wondering what is going on in Iraq, how it might affect Iran or be affecting disenfranchised voters that, you know, different groups within Iran, how they see what's going on, or the powerful religious conservatives in the government.
All right, I'll take the first question. The relationship between the clerics in Iraq and Iran, it's not really so much between the states, because obviously there is no Iraqi state. And in Iran, obviously, there was the division between reformers and conservatives. So the state itself was until recently very divided. The relationship is often between individuals. So if you have a cleric in Iraq who's a Shia, he would have, in a way, seminary links, personal links with fellow clerics who are across the border. And there's all constant back and forth between the two countries. Sistani himself, I think you mentioned, is Iranian, but he is considered the main Ayatollah in Iraq. But his origin is Iranian, and he speaks Arabic with an Iranian accent. And he also has a lot of supporters inside Iran. So there's a sort of overflow of Shiism across the border. So when someone, let's say, Sadr, does something or doesn't do something, it can't be explained by what is happening in Iran. They're doing it on their own invariably. But they might get help from their colleagues or compatriots or network, I would say, across the border. And Hezbollah, of course, as a Shia group in Lebanon, would have established links with many other Shia groups in Iraq. So I would imagine Sistani, as well as Sadr and Hakim, which is who is another Ayatollah, would have had already some sort of connections of assistance from Hezbollah, whether it's in terms of bodyguards, protection, technical help. So it's very hard to trace, let's say, activities to saying, well, it's some external organization that is controlling Saad or telling Sistani what to do. They're very much their own men and in many ways competitors.
I was thinking more of the reverse at this point. How would what these people are saying maybe have a back effect on Iranian politics, or, you know, what's going on there in terms of relations with the United States? And also, then, did you say that Hezbollah was founded in Lebanon? It doesn't have an origin in Iran or another kind of branch?
No, it's often confusing. There, a lot of Hezbollah is a general term,
right,
and there's sort of Hezbollahs all over the place.
Party of God.
Yeah, but the real Hezbollah is Lebanese, and it was formed in Lebanon among the Shia community. It was formed basically as a guerrilla organization to fight the Israeli occupation.
Mm-hmm.
And it got help from the Iranians. This was during the Lebanese, end of Lebanese civil war. In terms of how what's happening in Iran affects, in Iraq affects Iran, I don't think the Iranian regime itself has determined how it's affecting them, because the situation is so fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in a way, can see chaos. And one thing you can say is they don't want the chaos spreading. They don't want a civil war in Iraq, because that's going to be detrimental to them. But what to do about it is something that there would be for them no straight answer, because the U.S. is the powerful power, can make the determining basically choices. What the danger, I think, for the Iranians is to be too complacent or too confident, to feel that they have the upper hand, because U.S. is clearly now in a quagmire. And that because it's in that quagmire, the Iranian leadership will come to the conclusion that the U.S. then actually will be desperate for Iranian help to get the U.S. out of that quagmire. They've been talking in that way, but I don't think the U.S. would, under any circumstances, actually solicit Iranian help to solve the problem in Iraq, because the people in the defense and Bremer's office are adamantly opposed to the Iranian regime.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller here. I hope the caller will forgive me for wanting to go on. Let me just touch on, though, one of the questions I think initially you raised was something like, what is the Iranian interest in Iraq? The assumption, I think, early on of the United States was that the Iranians would feel that they have an interest simply because most of the Muslims in Iraq are from the same branch of Islam. And it seemed that the government of the United States was actually taking pains to tell Iran to mind its own business and stay out. So what interest does the government of Iran have in Iraq, and what happens from this point forward?
Well, one main interest Iran would have is to have no U.S. Troops there, which is, I think, obviously not a feasible wish, because the troops are going to be there for a long time. Aim is too strong a word. Their ideal, of course, would be to have in Iraq a regime that could represent the majority of the population of Iraq, which would be Shia. So even if it wasn't a clerical republic, it doesn't have to be a clerical republic, but it was a regime that was reflecting of the majority of Iraqis, that would be an actually favorable to Shiism. The dominant voice would be the Shias, and that would inevitably, but that would likely to bring it into a line not as a client of Iran so much as a sympathetic state of Iran. That would be the, I would say, the best Iran would wish for. But, of course, that wouldn't tally with U.S. interests, because the last thing I think the U.S. Bush's administration wanted was to remove Saddam Hussein and then have a regime in Iraq that would be leaning towards Iran. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons why the whole invasion of Iraq sounds insanity to most Middle East experts, because it was a no-win situation that even we got rid of Saddam Hussein. The idea that we were going to have a democratic republic there that would be very favorable to United States is just, it's not in the books. It never was in the books. It was only in the minds of the neoconservatives in Washington.
We have another caller here in Urbana. Let's talk with them. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Thanks for dealing with Hezbollah. Perhaps you'd explicate the relationship of Al-Qaeda and the Iranian state, in particular the religious party, because I think that's often perhaps misrepresented.
Yes, there have been attempts made, I think, by the neocons to say there is a secret link between the Iranian conservatives and Al-Qaeda. It's too far-fetched. And the State Department position has been, in fact, that this is too far-fetched because it would be very strange bedfellows. Al-Qaeda and the leadership, Bin Laden especially, come from Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabi tradition. And the Wahhabis, it's often forgotten, are basically obsessed about Shiism. They're as much obsessed about Shiism as they are about the West. For them, the main blasphemers and on the main transgressors of Islam have been the Shias. So there's this whole tradition goes back from the beginnings of Wahhabism in the 18th century. And twice, in fact, the Wahhabis invaded Iraq and carried out sacrilegious acts of the Shi shrines. So in the Shi world, the Wahhabis are considered also as despicable. So there is this long tradition. But in more recent years, in Afghanistan, the Iranians viewed Al-Qaeda as basically as a terrorist, murderous group because they were supporting the Taliban. And together with the Taliban, they had carried out massacres of the Hazaras in the north or the Shias. And in those massacres, they had actually killed a number of Iranian diplomats. So at one point, the Iranian army had mobilized on the front, ready to invade Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. So there is this sort of, also, besides the traditional animosity, the very recent animosity. So I would, I think it's too far-fetched to think there's any sort of link between the government, Iran, and Al-Qaeda. What has happened after the U.S. invasion is some Al-Qaeda people have probably fled into the Iran. There's a huge border, basically, that's uncontrollable. And they may have got arrested in Iran. And some of them have been sent back to their countries of origin. So some we know have been basically deported to Saudi Arabia, and some may be still detained there. But to jump from that to think that there's an Al-Qaeda organized link with the Iranians in terrorism there's no basically evidence, and all that I would say the logic would lead against that conclusion.
May I ask a question? I have a theory that the American Al-Qaeda war is largely a sideshow, that really the contest is between groups like Al-Qaeda and the major portion of the Islam, and that we happen to get in the way. I'm oversimplifying, I know.
Yeah. Well, you're right in one way that for Al-Qaeda, and you can go back to the theoreticians of the Islamist movements, the primary enemy are the what they consider the paganistic states that control the Arab world. So people like Mubarak, King of Morocco, the various secular states. Mm-hmm. So they were the main original targets, and they actually reinterpreted Islam to conclude that these states, even though they were in Islamic countries, were not really Islamic states, so they could be legitimately overthrown. And then the U.S. came in because they were supporting these states, and therefore the U.S. is an ally of their enemy. But besides that, with Al-Qaeda is also the issue of Palestine and Israel, because they have adopted that as part of their crusade. And then they perceive the United States as being an ally of Israel, and therefore U.S. is then an enemy of theirs.
I don't want to be interpreted as thinking that we should divorce ourselves from the Middle East because of what the entanglements may do, but it seems to me that it's dangerous to misinterpret the aims of Al-Qaeda. That we're not apt to be able to combat them if we do that.
Yes, I think, I mean, with terrorism, I think it's always the most important thing is to deal with the real underlying issues rather than the technical. The technical stuff is obviously important, but the issue is not going to be resolved unless you get to the roots of it. And I think the roots here are, besides basically the undemocratic states, even more important than that is the issue of Palestine. So that's why I think most Europeans, whenever they talk about resolving or dealing with terrorism, they link it with the issue of the Palestinian-Israeli dispute and encouraging United States to move on that as a primary issue. In fact, yesterday the new Spanish foreign minister said that we really can't deal with terrorism unless we try to resolve the Palestinian issue.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Irfan Abrahamian. He's an historian at Baruch College in New York City, part of the City University of New York. And he's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk later this afternoon. We're talking about your politics in Iran, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Urbana, line 2.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to know how is the relation of Iranian government with Britain, British?
It was actually very good until, I would say, almost last month. It was very good because if you see the links between the British Foreign Office in Iran, as soon as the war on terrorism started, the British Foreign Secretary went to Iran. They actually brokered the deal between Iran and United States about getting Iranian help in the war in Afghanistan. And that good relationship has continued. Now, what has put the spokes in the wheel is the nuclear issue, because the British, like the rest of the Europeans, are insistent that Iran should not develop a nuclear bomb. So when it comes to the nuclear issue and inspections, the British, like the European Union and America, are all basically working together to put pressure on Iran to not to go to that step of actually assembling a nuclear bomb. And that obviously doesn't go too well with the conservatives in power in Tehran.
Thank you.
All right. And another Urbana caller. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. Is this me?
Yes.
When I was a child in Tehran, as an Armenian child, we had one representative in the parliament who I don't think took part in the discussions, but sort of represented us. And I believe the Jewish minority also had one. What is the situation now?
The minorities have actually now five representatives. It's the same as before. The Jewish community has one. Armenians have two. The Zoroastrians have one. It's a total of four representatives.
But do they take part in the discussions?
Yes, they do. I think the gentleman you were referring to was notorious for not taking part. In fact, the one time he got up, everyone was very eagerly listening to what he had to say, and his request was whether they could open the window. Yes. No, the recent ones are quite active, and one comes from North and South, and they are not obviously affiliated with the formerly reformers and so on, but they tend to support the reformers in voting.
Now, I read the Etelaat newspaper, the one in Persian, and I see absolutely nothing about Jews, Armenians, Assyrians. What's going on? Have they gone underground?
No. I think actually the community is quite lively. It's just they have their own newspapers.
Yeah, I know that.
But it's the the communities, in a way, are still there, but shrunk in terms of immigration of
your problem. How large is it?
It's
the Armenian one.
Armenian is over 100,000.
Oh, it's
yeah,
big.
Yeah, yeah. But of course, it's not as big as it was in 1979. And same, the Jewish community is about half what it was.
Which is what?
I think it's about 20,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. We're coming to the point where we have this maybe 2 or 3 minutes left. There's so much we could talk about. If we had another hour, I'm sure then we could fill it. What I'm interested in, perhaps as a way of finishing up, is how it is you see things developing now in the region, particularly in light of the Iraq war, and how Iran will participate in that dynamic, because it certainly is it's positioned to be a major player if it was allowed to do so. And I guess here the main obstacle would be the current state of relations between Iran and the United States.
Yes, I mean, the Iranian argument always is they're a major power, so U.S. should recognize them as a major power in the Gulf. And as long as that's not done, then Iran is not treated properly. So it's a question from there of honor and respect and so on. It's not quite clear what being treated with respect would really mean. I think the conservatives mean that, well, we should develop a bomb and you should accept that. That clearly, obviously, is not going to go down too well in Washington. But that would have been, I would say, all the sort of issues in the past. Now I think it's so chaotic with the war that really the policymakers are not thinking in those terms. Mm-hmm. We're in a completely different ball game where United States has entered, I would say, real hell, and there is no way of getting out of it. So I would see a permanent state of chaos in which really no permanent relationships could be established. And the danger could be, in fact, that if after the November election this administration remains, that they might actually want to expand the war into Iran, because that would be, from their way of trying to solve the unsolvable problem in Iraq. That wouldn't mean occupation of Iran, but some action to destroy the Iranian regime, because the people in key positions have been for the last 25 years been adamant that they want a regime change in Iran. So they haven't been the question. They haven't been talking about normalizing relations with Iran. In the State Department, yes, they talk about that. But in the White House, in the defense, they're much more the talk is regime change. And if they get a chance, they would be quite happy to strike at Iran and basically try to take out the whole regime.
Mm. Well, we'll have to stop. For people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Irvan Abrahamian from Baruch College in New York City, he'll be speaking on Iranian politics and U.S. foreign policy as part of the MillerCom series this afternoon, 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. He's also authored a number of books on Iran and is a contributor to a forthcoming book to be published by the New Press titled Inventing the Axis of Evil, The Truth About North Korea, Iran, and Syria. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.